Hi, this is Tim Keel. Welcome to the Jacobswell Podcast. For this week's sermon, or any of the sermons in our archive, subscribe for free in iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Jacobswell is a church that relies on the support of its community. We consider you a part of that community, and we'd love for you to participate with us in our financial life. You can do that on our website and in the Jacobswell mobile app. Whether you're new to this space or a regular podritioner, we're glad you're here.
I have the good fortune of being able to introduce the teacher that is going to be teaching us today. Ian Davidson is a guy who has never taught here. I don't know that he's ever preached before. Maybe? No, maybe not. This may be his second time. He did it once at 9. But I've been here for a really long time. I've been here for about 14 years, a little over. And right when I had started, there were about 75 people coming to Jacob's Well. And one of those people was Ian Davidson. And he was living in Manhattan, Kansas, and driving here every Sunday. And I remember one day, he was like, hey, can we go to lunch? And so we went to lunch at Oklahoma Joe's when it was back then, when that was what it was called. And he said, I'm moving to Kansas City. And I'm like, yes. Ian was one of those guys that I just made an immediate connection with. He's a great friend. He's been a faithful part of the worship team. He's been playing guitar for 13 years. He's led worship. You may recognize him from having led worship. He is an elder at Jacob's Well. So here's my commendation, or here's my why I, or what I think about Ian. I don't know what I'm saying. What am I saying? What I'm saying is this. When I was a little bit younger and my children were about to enter into their teenage years, I had a lot of fear and trembling, and I didn't know how to be a dad of a teenage son. And my wife, who is much wiser than I am in many regards, said, why don't you just look at somebody who you think turned out really great and then go talk to their dad? And so that's what I did. And that person who I decided that I would love my children to be like one day is Ian Davidson. So let's welcome Ian. Ian Davidson.
Good morning. He said something similar at the first service. I didn't realize what the intro was going to be. And I'm kind of blown away by that. And part of it is that I have spent my entire adult life with this community. And I love you guys. I do. But that's not really the message. We're going to get past that really quick. So a couple of nights ago, I was hanging out with my older brother. I'm the middle of three boys, my older brother Seth, and I was over at his house, and we got on the topic of television commercials we remember from our childhood, which was, roughly like mid to late 80s, maybe even spilling over into the early 90s. And I found out something about my older brother on Friday night. And I don't know, this was pretty obscure. I didn't totally remember it until he started telling me about it. Does anybody remember Billy Smith, the tree climbing expert? All right, so we have a few. Let me explain it to you, and maybe more of you will remember like I did. It was a public service announcement from the power company telling kids not to climb trees near overhead lines, right? And what I found out about my brother is it's been almost 30 years since he's seen that spot, and he has the whole thing memorized. He still knows every word to it, complete with voice inflection, So he was he gets to the climax of the spot where the kid just says, and climbing utility poles is really dumb, right? I heard somebody over here say it with me, yes. Oh my gosh. And so from there, we started trading slogans back and forth. We got on YouTube and we watched old commercials that we remembered and we laughed. And so I thought maybe I'd just start today with inviting you guys into that conversation, maybe testing your memory a bit about commercials from about 30 years ago. So I've got a series of questions and fill in the blanks, and we're not going to do the Jacob's Well thing where we're really polite and raise our hand. We're all just going to shout out the answer, okay? So the first one is a question. How many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop? three is right. I feel like I heard someone say four. Is that true? No, it's three. Three is the right answer. Next one is fill in the blank. Silly rabbit tricks. Well done. Well done. This one may be a little harder. They're always after me. All right. It would have helped if I did an Irish accent. I get it. Only you can prevent. Yes. This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions? I really thought that that would be like the home run. And like 9 o'clock kind of struggled with it too. So, and then after that, after we'd done that for a while, the conversation switched again to, I wish I could forget that one. I wish I could forget that commercial, but somehow it's stuck with me all of these years. And the one I brought up was this.
It's Slinky, it's Slinky. For fun, it's a wonderful toy. When it walks downstairs, a loner in pairs, and makes a slinkity sound. A spring, a marvelous thing. Everyone knows it's Slinky. It's Slinky, it's Slinky. For fun, it's a wonderful toy. It's fun for a girl and a boy. It's fun for a girl and a boy.
Get a Slinky in a size and color you like, in metal or plastic.
I gotta be honest, like just the egregious product shots, they're ridiculous. And then that song is just terrible, right? The song is awful. And I remember being 6 or 7 or 8 years old and seeing that commercial and thinking, really, Slinky? Really? The best thing you can think to say about yourself is that you do not discriminate by gender, that you are for a girl and a boy. That is the main message of this spot, and that's the best you got. And yet, here we are, 30 years later, and I can't forget it as much as I would like to, right? So what is it about these commercials that have a way of just sticking with us, right? A couple weeks ago, Brendan Benz was speaking. He said something that kind of stopped me. And I think it was probably to him kind of a throwaway, but I got really stuck on it, and he said this. He said, successful advertising is based on articulating a message that appeals to our human nature. Advertising doesn't seek to subvert the laws of our nature. They draw them in. How do you feel about that? I'm not actually asking for responses. I think, as I think about it, like there are several emotions that come to mind. One is just anger. Right? Like, really, that's the world we live in? Where we just trick people? Or do you just find it repulsive? Like, yep, that's capitalism at work. Yeah. Or do you feel kind of exposed or vulnerable because of it? Or do you feel like kind of embarrassed because you've been tricked? Or maybe you just know that advertising is this reality of the world we live in, and you're exposed to so many advertisements that you're just numb to it. And so you actually don't think that much about it, it's just the way it is. And so a quick confession, that's me. I'm an ad guy. That's what I do for a living, and I love what I do. And here's why. Because so far, I've made a career out of helping companies remember that at the end of every product they sell, there's a person, there's a human being, not a theory, not a target audience, not a mindless individual that's easy to manipulate, but a real person like me and you that has veins and arteries, and they have aspirations. And they wake up every day and they go into a job because they probably want to provide for a family themselves in some form or another. And they wake up each morning and they're constantly distracted and they're always in a hurry and they probably feel insecure and probably feel a bit overwhelmed, just like we do. And so far, the most amazing revelation of my advertising career is that I can actually go into these companies and use advertising as a way to advocate for people, real people. I can walk into a boardroom of the PepsiCo headquarters in Chicago and talk about the human struggle that we're all dealing with and talk with PepsiCo executives about how do you solve the human struggle? Forget moving more bottles of Gatorade just for a second. Forget about more juice boxes or cereal boxes or plane tickets, whatever client I'm talking to. Forget about that for a second. How do we solve a real human struggle? How do we actually leverage the full weight of your brand to make people's lives better? And I think the most surprising thing is I'm constantly dealing with people who didn't ever hear that in business school. And so they love that conversation because it's so different for them, right? It's such a different conversation. It's something they didn't learn in business school or in their years of managing a brand. And so the point is this: I love advertising, but it's not about the product. It's about the humanity behind the product. Why was that developed? What's the emotional need that people have where it makes sense to even have this product out there? Why is it different than other products? And most importantly, how will it literally make people's lives better? Because if it isn't going to, I'm just not that interested in it. And when advertising gets it right, I think we as people see it and we learn something about ourselves, actually. It exposes something in our subconscious that we didn't know exactly was there. And so I'd like to, if I can, it's not Slinky again, it's a way better commercial. I'd like to play a better commercial for you, one of my favorites that I think does this really, really well.
The Chinese calendar said this was the year of the snake, but it wasn't. Sorry, snake. It was the year of the you. Think of all you've done. Think of all you've accomplished. Think about March. Something happened in March. I don't know what, but you know. You were the one who did it. It was your year. You're the one who made another human being. You're the one who hasn't slept in months and who's walking around like a zombie. Like a big, happy zombie. You're the one who got married, who found that one person, one out of like 7 billion, who you're meant to be with. One. That's like what spies can do. And they have facial recognition technology. And all you had is a new shirt. But you did it. You're the one who bought a house, or got a new job, or went on that business trip to Des Moines and bonded with your coworkers in Des Moines, like really bonded with your coworkers in Des Moines, and still pulled off the 7 a.m. presentation. You. You're the one who gave your favorite shirt to charity. You love that shirt, but you gave it to someone else who needed it. Yeah, your wife made you, but you did it. You did a lot this year. Nobody knows that better than you. So we think you can answer questions about the things you did. Simple questions like, did you get married? Did you have a baby? Did you buy a house? That's what taxes are. A recap. The story of your year. And that's why we make the tools we make. That's why we do everything we do. Because we think you should be the one to tell that story. We think you're the best person to do your taxes. Intuit TurboTax. It's amazing what you're capable of.
So if you think you're desensitized to advertising, try working in the industry for 10 years. And then it becomes so surprising when you see a spot like that and you almost cry. And you text it to your wife and you say, watch this, because I just felt something that I don't normally feel when I engage in advertising. Because I fundamentally agree with that spot. It's way more about the people, the humanity, the human experience than it is about the product, and we can all relate to that. And honestly, I feel like I learned something from it too. You know, when I watched it, I can pretty vividly remember saying, man, it would be good if I took the time to remember all of the amazing, beautiful, exciting things that have changed in my life in the last year. I should take more time to reflect, and I just don't do it because life's so busy. I don't use TurboTax yet, but I mean, it made me really feel something deep. But the point is, it's not the product, right? It's what's behind the product. And oftentimes, brands forget this. This is why advertising just becomes white noise. Their brand grows stale. Their products stop feeling fresh. Their message stops resonating, and it loses relevance. And then, quite frankly, that's probably why I have a job, because they bring me in to help them craft a different story for that product or brand. So why the long introduction? Because for me, the passage we are tackling today has actually always felt pretty stale. It's kind of like the TV spots from our childhood. It's really not a stretch to say, in my estimation, we are going to cover the Slinky commercial of the scriptures. It just hasn't felt fresh or relevant to me. I grew up going to church, and I can remember as part of that experience, I went to a church that would hang banners in the sanctuary that just had like different Christian slogans on them, right? And this was kind of the one, the hero slogan out of all the banners. It's just so familiar that it stopped meaning anything to me. So without further ado, let's get on to that passage, right? It is John 6, 35, 41 to 51. It's kind of long, so I will just read it today, but please follow along. Then Jesus declared, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." And at this, the Jews began to grumble about him because he said, "I am the bread that came down from heaven." They said, "Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he now say, 'I came down from heaven'?" "Stop grumbling among yourselves," Jesus answered. "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws them, and I will raise them up on the last day. It is written in the prophets, they will all be taught by God. Everyone who has heard the Father and learned from him comes to me. No one has seen the Father except the one who is from God. Only he has seen the Father. Very truly, I tell you, the one who believes has eternal life. I am the bread of life. Your ancestors ate manna in the wilderness, and yet they died. But here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which anyone may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world." So I got several problems with this. First one is just bread of life. It's a super weak tagline, you know? It's just wallpaper to me. Feels like background noise. It seems like the kind of thing you ought to see on a church banner, but not maybe the kind of thing that should change your life, really. It's just really overplayed. And then you've got the second part. Man, that's tough to read, you know? I think Jesus so often in scriptures shows these flashes of brilliance as a storyteller, as an orator, as a copywriter. But I can honestly tell you, I feel like in this passage, he didn't have his A game that day. Like, he just kept talking, right? Like, brevity is our friend in advertising, and Jesus didn't get that, and so he belabors the point for a really long time, and it's honestly a really similar point you find really shortly and really succinctly elsewhere in Scripture where he just says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." So that's why I think the passage is stale. Tagline's just been in market too long, guys, and so... I'm going to do the only thing I really know how to do, which is reposition it. Because this is less of a sermon, and I think it's just more of an exploration. And the exploration begins with this observation. When you look at the people in the story, and when you feel the tension that is resident within the story, you really are only left with one conclusion: that what was being said was not stale to Jesus. And it was not stale to the people that heard it. So what am I missing? I went out to try to find the answer to that question, and I just found it in this story. And the story goes like this. In the beginning, there was a garden, and the garden was good. And God put two people in the garden, and he gave them one simple rule: don't eat that. You can eat the other fruit, you can eat the vegetables, you can eat the seeds, you can eat the sprouts, you can eat anything else, just not that. And we know how the story goes. They couldn't help themselves. They were tempted, and they ate it, and then God hands down this unbelievably severe punishment. Get out. They had to leave. And on their way out, he hit them with these parting words: "By the sweat of your face, you will eat bread until you return to the ground." And I think when we read this, like we kind of understand that this is just part of the curse. that we have to toil for our own food. But if we're being honest, most people in this room don't actually know what it's like to toil for their food, right? It's not a reality that a lot of us actually go through, because we can go to the store whenever we want to and we can walk out with a loaf of bread. And while we may conceptually understand that there's a process that goes into making that loaf of bread, and it probably involves wheat and it probably involves flour and it probably involves an oven and it probably involves packaging and some sort of truck to get it to the supermarket, we actually don't know the process at all. And there's still many parts of the developing world where the curse is played out each and every day, and it looks something like this. First, you have to plow the field, and you likely had to make your own plow, and you had to weave your own rope, and you had to train your own animals to pull it, and despite that, it's not easy work, because the ground is uneven, and with every step, you hit a rock, or a rut, or a root. It's hard work to get through it. And once the ground is prepared, it's time to plant seed. And every seed that's put into the ground represents an act of faith that this seed will sprout and grow, that the rains will come and that the locusts won't. And when it rains, you feel relief. And if it's hot and dry, you feel anxious and you start scheming. You start coming up with a plan B because it's your livelihood and your family's livelihood that is at stake. And then they just wait. They wait, and they pray, and they watch, and they wait. And for me, this would be the most excruciating part, right? The touch and go of the day-to-day. If it rains, you feel relief. But let's say it all goes well, and the crop ripens. Then you've got the harvest, and this is the tedious and tiring work of reaping the crop, bundling it, and preparing for it to be processed. But taking the wheat or barley from plant to bread has really just started. You have to separate the edible parts of the plant from the inedible parts, and so you thresh it. You shock the plant into cracking open and giving you the part that you want. And then after that, you winnow it. You actually put it into a basket like you're panning for gold, and you separate the chaff, which is the lighter casing, from the actual part you want to keep. And then you grind those kernels that are left over into flour, and you sift it to remove the rest of the lighter foreign matter. And only then can you mix it with liquid and knead it into dough. And in Jesus' day, they ate bread for every meal. This was a constant task. It was half a day's work spent just making bread for three meals, and during the sowing and the harvesting seasons, even more. 3 to 4 hours a day, every day except the Sabbath, all year. This is what the curse looks like. But there's also something way more subtle going on here, because this is actually the first mention of bread in the Bible. Up until this point, you had talked about fruits and vegetables and seeds and sprouts, but this is the first time that all of those have been combined to make something else, bread. So the question is, how'd that happen? And it's really hidden in this text. By the sweat of your face will you get bread to eat until you return to the ground. The question becomes, by whose sweat did Adam and Eve get bread in the garden? If it's by their sweat afterwards, by whose sweat did they eat it in the garden? And there's several different traditions that have points of view on this. There is an ancient rabbinical tradition where they said, you know, it's really simple. In the garden, they just had trees like we don't have today. And those trees grew fully formed loaves of bread. That's like the fairies and elves version, right? Then there's other texts that tell the story of Adam and Eve, other ancient texts where they actually say God and the angels taught Adam and Eve how to plant the fields, how to sow, how to reap, how to go through the process, and they would help them do it. But I gotta tell you, my favorite explanation that completely ignites my imagination is that Adam and Eve didn't make their own bread in the garden. God did. That in essence, he actually modeled breaking bread for us before we even knew that it was a thing to do. Because he knew that sharing a meal with someone is the fastest way to move them from acquaintance to friend. The other thing it would communicate is this God isn't like the other gods out there, because before we ever brought him a sacrifice, He brought something to us. And so you have this kernel of this idea that starts in the first chapter of Genesis and then is kind of woven throughout Scripture, and the people knew it. We know it's our God because when our God shows up, he brings bread. And you heard that last week when Jesse was talking through Exodus 16, when the Israelites leave Egypt and they cross the river and they get into the desert, and then they're hungry and they have nothing and they start to grumble. And God showed up and he doubled down on his reputation, and he was the God that brought them bread again. And interestingly enough, it must have not looked like what they expected, right? Because they looked at it and said, what's this? What is this? When they saw bread, they didn't even recognize it. And out of this story comes another Jewish practice that started then, persists through today. It's a process of blessing the bread called making hamotzi. And there's many steps to the process, but there's one spoken part. And then the blessing over the bread, when it's spoken, sounds like this. They say, blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the universe, who brings forth bread from the earth. And this is a fitting blessing for the God of Exodus, who brings forth bread from the earth. And yet, our experience with bread today is not that it comes from the earth, right? Maybe the individual pieces or ingredients, some of them do, but the actual bread is kind of weird language, right? So what does it mean? Again, several theories about it. Some people think it just refers to the bread that was given in the desert, right? So we are thanking God on behalf of all of the bread that we have consumed to date, particularly the cultural application of bread in the desert. Others say, no, it's about all the things that go into the bread that we are eating today, right? So it's a blessing for today. But then the majority actually believe that neither of those are true. They believe it refers to the future because they call bread the life giver. And so it's just a proxy for the Messiah that is to come to manifest his full life that bread just represents. And so this prayer is actually a promise of what is to come. But there's a danger in these stories, because if we forget that both of these stories are first relational, we're led to a conclusion that was never intended. And the conclusion would be that God brings bread to just make our lives easier. And that's really what brings us to the story that both Brendan and Jesse have talked about the past couple of weeks, the feeding of the 5,000. With two fish and five barley loaves, Jesus shows us that he is the God that brings bread, that they are one. And in doing so, he reenacts both the garden narrative and the Exodus narrative in one act. And their response is unbelievable, really. They try to make him king by force. And then when Jesus just smoke bombs, he just disappears. And they find him the next day, and he's not having any of it. He just kind of cuts to the chase, and essentially he says, you want me to be king because you want bread, not because of who I am. In other words, you want me to be your king because you think I'm going to make your life easier. You think I'm going to save you 3 or 4 hours a day, every day, by giving you bread for 40 years, like your ancestors in the desert, because you want your life to be easier. And then, just like the people didn't recognize that manna was bread in the desert, they don't recognize that he's God. They say, yeah, Moses provided that. And he's like, wrong. And that's when the gloves come off. And that's when you get the bread of life passage. It's not a meek and mild Christian story that belongs on banners and sanctuaries. It's what happens when Jesus stops telling parables and starts getting direct, because he's not beating around the bush anymore. He pulls no punches, and he says, essentially, none of your stories about bread are actually about bread. They're about relationships. They're about hospitality. They're about my heart and your heart meeting somewhere in the middle. They're about the extraordinary lengths I will go to try to reach you. But if you want to keep up your bread analogy, I can do that too. I'm the bread. So it's not a throwaway statement. It's a mic drop. And everyone's stunned because in just a few short words, he has completely reinterpreted their past, their present, and their future. Oh, you want things to be easy like they were in the garden. But the garden actually wasn't about making lives easy. It was about us being together. Oh, you want me to give you bread for the next 40 years like in the Exodus? I can actually one-up that. How about you and me and my father just share meals together forever? And what about yesterday? It's really simple. I saw that you were hungry, and I wanted to be the God that brings you bread. And that blessing that you say three times a day when you give thanks for your bread, that's actually about me. I'm the bread that's going to come forth from the earth after 3 days. So how do people respond? In truth, not that well. Not that well at all. There are actually three responses. If you look at the entirety of the text, today's passage only had one of the three. But I think I'm going to go through all of them just because I think we have some similar responses when we're confronted with similar things. To the Jews, they just responded with anger. Who does this guy think he is? How dare you put words in my mouth? How dare you tell me what my prayers mean or don't mean? Are you even qualified to interpret the Torah? Because last I checked, you were Joseph's son. If Jesus wasn't going to be a product of Jewish culture, then he was immediately declared persona non grata, an unwelcome person. And the thing about Jesus is he will bring up our past, he will reframe our present, and he will chart a new course for our future, and he doesn't ask permission. So I don't know where you're at, but I've certainly been at points in my life where I feel like Jesus is just not asking permission, and it just makes me angry. The second response is the masses. And for the most part, they didn't say anything. They just left. Because if he wasn't going to make their lives easier, then they were going to move on and find a different product that would. Because they weren't interested in friendship. They just wanted each and every handout that Jesus was given. So they were interested more in Jesus as a product than they were as a person. You see, the problem with Jesus as a product is that with our products, we get to dictate the terms of use. Is it the right thing for the right price? Will it solve this kind of one persistent problem in my life? Do I look good in it, you know? Will it make us more efficient? And if not, we just get a new product that maybe will work better. Here's the thing, is the product of Jesus is actually really easy not to buy. Because he's really clear, the cost is high. And I think for me, as I've been preparing for this, this is the thing that gets me the most, is I've had to ask myself the question, what's following Jesus really cost me? And the answer is not all that much so far. So I've got room to grow. I think when you replace a product with a person, the stakes just become a whole lot higher because people have this way of changing us, of influencing us, of affecting us, of hurting us, of healing us, of making us vulnerable. They call us out. They empathize with us. They cry with us. They invite us. And that leads us to the third response, which was the disciples. After the crowds left, Jesus turned to them and said, "What about you 12? Are you going to go too?" And Peter, kind of in classic form, just says, "To whom would we go?" It's the kind of thing you can only say when you've gotten to the person behind the product. Let's pray. God, when you bring bread, it is a move of the heart. It's not just about sustaining us physically. It's about relating to us. It's about moving us from acquaintance to friend. And in that act, we all too often are focused on what you're bringing instead of who you are. Forgive us. Allow us to look past the product to the person of Jesus. Amen.
This podcast is a part of Jacob's Well Church in Kansas City. Our website is jacobswellchurch.org. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/jacobswellkc. You can find us on Instagram at jacobswell. If you'd like to participate in our financial life, you can do that on our website and in the Jacobs Well mobile app, available in the Apple and Android app stores. May the Lord bless and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious unto you. May the Lord turn his face to you and grant you his peace. Amen.